طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. Today we check in with Ali Abu Nima, one of the Palestinian journalists we have come to rely on for up-to-date analysis of the action on the streets in Palestine. He is co-founder of the Electronic Intifada, which we highly recommend you to follow online to receive current news and analysis from Palestine. Ali is also an author of numerous books, but is best known as an activist and advocate for Palestine whose parents were driven out in 1948 and now reside in Jordan. Today, Ali Abu Nima joins Michael Spath, the director of the Indiana Center for Middle East Peace, in conversation discussing current developments in Palestine and the United States. We begin with a question from Michael Spath.
Ali, you referenced being here in Fort Wayne. When you were here almost 2 years ago now, the title of your talk, I don't know if you remember, but the title of your talk audaciously was "The Palestinians Are Winning."
Well, you know, I think my title, the Palestine, or my opening sentence to my book, "The Palestinians Are Winning," was audacious when I wrote it, and it's still now, but I still very much stand by it. And you know, to be clear what I mean, I'm certainly not underestimating the amount of suffering and the amount of oppression that Israel is still inflicting on Palestinians. But what I was referring to is the change in political discourse, really the political sea change, which I think we're seeing with the kinds of electoral wins that you just mentioned in the past slew of elections. And I think other signs of this deep change in discussion were when just a couple of weeks ago, Peter Beinart, the sort of the well-known liberal Zionist writer, basically came out and said that he no longer supports a two-state solution. And instead of seeking Israeli-Palestinian separation, which has really been the model for many decades, we should be seeking Palestinian and Israeli-Jewish equality. So I think those changes are still escalating and or accumulating, and nothing I see the Israel lobby doing, Israel and its lobby doing, to try to silence us, to try to put this discussion back in the model. Nothing I see them doing is really working. But that is not to underestimate the scale of the challenges we still face.
I want to say that I want you to say a little bit more about the situation here in the U.S. We'll get to the presidential election later on, but even with these victories in the congressional primaries, the Washington Post ran an op-ed just last Friday that written by three Palestinian American human rights activists entitled "The 2020 Democratic Platform Betrays Palestinians and Again Gives Israel a Pass." Mm. So even with these victories, there's still a number of hurdles yet to be jumped. Talk a little bit about the Democratic platform and maybe some other obstacles.
Yeah, what we're seeing in the Democratic platform fight is really a microcosm of the battle that has been raging in the grassroots of the Democratic Party for a number of years. And so the primary victories we've seen by some progressives who are very open about their support for Palestinian rights, even supportive of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, comes against a backdrop where the establishment is still very firmly in the old model, where you don't criticize Israel, where unquestioning support for Israel is the one bipartisan issue. That's the one thing they agree with the Republicans on. And so that's what you get with a nominee or as he is going to be the nominee, someone like Joe Biden, who spent his entire career in that mold, who is a very strong supporter of Israel, and who will use whatever control or leverage he has over the apparatus of the Democratic Party to force that agenda on everyone else. And so that's the battle that's taking place. What we saw in the platform committee really in the last week or so, as we've seen in previous years, when Bernie Sanders was more involved in it last year and the efforts to put in the platform language that at least acknowledges Palestinian rights, at least acknowledges the reality that Palestinians are living under Israeli occupation. And this year, that's what happened as well. There were efforts to amend the platform to include recognition of Israeli occupation, to place very modest conditions on Israel, on U.S. military aid to Israel. And those were rejected completely by the establishment, by the, let's say, the corporate establishment wing of the Democratic Party. But that's not going to make these issues go away, and it's not going to silence the grassroots. I think if anything, it's going to feed the determination of grassroots activists to ensure that their voices are heard, because it's not just on the question of Palestine that the party establishment is shutting people out. Similarly, one of the most popular policies in the grassroots of the Democratic Party is Medicare for All. The platform, they wouldn't even allow a vote on that, let alone to actually adopt that as the party policy. So you have to see the question of Palestine within the broader context of the fight in the Democratic Party. I'm not so confident that the fight can ever really be won within the Democratic Party the way it is. A lot of people are saying, well, maybe we need to find an alternative. I think that comes out of the frustration that many people feel time and again, seeing grassroots voices and progressive voices shut out and slapped down. But nevertheless, the battle goes on, and when there are victories in it, we celebrate them.
You were one of the very first people to that I know of to talk about the one state solution. We've interviewed Awad Abdel Fattah and Jeff Halper in this platform about their plan. How do you assess the situation these days, given Israel's annexation plans?
Well, I mentioned Peter Beinart coming to the conclusion that a one-state solution is inevitable. And of course, that created a lot of discussion, and he was given an op-ed in the New York Times and was invited onto many shows to talk about his views. And as many people pointed out, these are positions that Palestinians, including myself, had been talking about for many, many years. Myself, my book, One Country, Putting Forward a One-State Solution, came out, I think, in 2006. So that's 14, almost 15 years ago now. For us, for people like us, maybe it's old news. But it was big news for a lot of the people who followed Peter Beinart or who read the New York Times or who listen to NPR, for whom the idea of a one state solution was just so remote. But the key point here is that the recognition of those like Peter Beinart, that this is now the way to go, comes from an understanding of the reality on the ground, that it is already one single state, but it is one single state ruled by Israel according to a very unjust, very oppressive apartheid regime, and that the effort to separate Palestinians and Israelis would do more violence and be more difficult and be more unjust ultimately than giving people full and equal rights, making restitution, making reparations, and seeking truth and justice and reconciliation. Those things aren't by any means easy. Let's not pretend they're easy. But that is the path that has been pursued in pretty much every similar situation that we can think of, whether it's in South Africa or whether it's in Northern Ireland. And in the past few days, John Hume passed yeah. away, who was one of the key figures in making the agreement happen. And I, in my book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine, I look at both Northern Ireland and South Africa as potential models, not only to learn what was successful, but also what we should do better, because there's plenty of shortcomings in what was attempted in those places, and those are experiences we should build on, not simply try to replicate.
Your dad just a week ago wrote a wonderful op-ed in the Jordan Times about the one state solution and about how it's de facto. I mean, exactly what you said, how Israel has made it a de facto one state. And of course, that's something, like you said, we've known for a long time now, but it still is news to many people. And especially since the official stance of the United States and Jordan and so many other countries is two state. You've been writing recently, Ali, as well as your other reporters, about what's happening in Europe. So Germany recently awarded Zippy Livni their Bridge Peace Prize. Their new anti-Semitism chief, I think you just wrote about this yesterday, is anti-Palestinian. Yet their left-wing party, Die Linke, is calling for sanction on Israel if the annexation proceeds. The same for a vocal minority within the EU. Sweden, though, is encouraging business with Israel's high-tech startups linked to its surveillance industry and cyber warfare. So talk to us just in general about what's happening in Europe with regard to Israel and Palestine. And there are signs of hope, but there are also some danger signs too, right?
Yeah, well, first let me say thank you for being such a close reader of the Electronic Intifada, because those are very much all stories that we've covered in recent weeks and months. And, I'm very interested in what's happening in Europe, because I think a lot of us have this idea that, as we know, the United States is incredibly biased towards Israel. It's the biggest donor of military aid and, in countless ways that I think many of us are familiar with. Many of us have this impression that Europe and the European Union is somehow more even-handed, somehow more in support of Palestinian rights. And sadly, that's not true. When we're talking about official positions and government policies, it's not true. The way I like to put it is that the European Union is Donald Trump, who, has a discerning taste in fine wines. That's sadly what it is. And we see that in terms of the massive amounts of weapons trade between European countries and Israel. We see that in the massive amount of other trade, including trade with Israel settlements. There's far more settlement goods that go to the European Union than come to the United States, just because Europe is geographically closer to Israel. So when you're talking about shipping of, farm produce, that tends to go to Europe rather than to the United States. And European governments have been absolutely unwilling to impose any consequences on Israel whatsoever. They are all talk, all bark and no bite, let's say, and not that much bark to begin with. I mean, they're very cautious about criticizing Israel. And what, there are a number of factors in this. I mean, one is, a major one is Europe's general subservience to the United States. Donald Trump notwithstanding, the European governments still see themselves as the junior partners of the Americans and want the Americans to protect them. So they tend to see the world through Washington's eyes, even if there are some nuances. But there are also specific factors related to Europe's history, and particularly in Germany, where what has developed in Germany is really a very unhealthy situation where Germans are unfortunately, of course, some are, but I'm talking about the mainstream, Germans are very uncritical about their history. Instead of learning the lesson, I mean, the absolute horrors of the genocide committed by the German government against European Jews, the lesson ought to be, I mean, this is the lesson I was taught, never again for anyone. And the lesson that Germany seems to have learned is rather than being courageous about criticizing human rights abuses wherever they are and standing up for people's rights wherever they are, the lesson has been just unquestioning support for Israel, arms sales to Israel, attacking people who are working for Palestinian human rights, attacking people who support the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. And we've seen a recent trend, which started in the United States, but was then copied in Europe, of appointing officials to be sort of the anti-Semitism, the person in charge of the fight against anti-Semitism. And let me be clear, in principle, I have no problem with appointing, someone to lead the fight against racism, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism. That's a good thing. But what has actually happened in the United States and in Europe, in country after country, and at the EU level, is the appointment of people who are very close to the Israel lobby and who spend very little time actually fighting anti-Semitism and a lot of time fighting the Palestinian rights movement. I mean, to take a shocking example, there was an article in the New York Times, I think the day before yesterday, about the extent to which German state institutions, including the police, have been infiltrated by neo-Nazis with hit lists and death lists. And this has been exposed in recent years about the extent to which there are still Nazi networks in Germany. These anti-Semitism commissioners are almost never talking about that. Instead, what they've been doing is pushing this misleading and politically motivated definition of anti-Semitism and trying to get governments and institutions to adopt it. It's a definition which basically equates criticism of Israel and Zionism on the one hand with anti-Jewish bigotry on the other. And that is the situation. And in Germany, they're taking it to an extreme. So the German National Anti-Semitism Coordinator and the one just appointed by the state of Berlin have been very vocal in attacking and smearing supporters of Palestinian rights, to the point where this guy who was just appointed by the state of Berlin tweeted in October that, apropos of nothing, that if you're, say, riding on a train and you hear someone mention the word Palestine, you should start screaming at them. Mm-hmm. And this is the guy who's in charge of, the state of Berlin's fight against anti-Semitism. And in his tweet, he equated this, you know, saying the word Palestine with anti-Semitism. So that's what we're up against. But let me say that in Europe, there have also been significant and notable victories, including in June, the European Court of Human Rights, really in a landmark ruling, ruled that support for the boycott of Israeli goods is a free speech right protected by the European Convention on Human Rights. And it overturned the convictions of 12 activists in France who had been criminally prosecuted by French authorities for calling on the Carrefour supermarket chain not to stock Israeli goods. They had been criminally prosecuted, and that was thrown out. And that was really a landmark ruling upholding the right of European citizens to advocate for Palestinian human rights, and indeed human rights in general.
I want to ask you about the anti-BDS resolutions. More and more in our country and around the world, Canada being a recent example, there are resolutions and laws passed that are restricting speech critical of Israel. You just mentioned it in Germany as well. Do you see this as a backlash against the success of BDS, or a case is two steps forward, three steps backward?
I think it's primarily a backlash, but it definitely absorbs a lot of people's energy in trying to fight this. You know, that's time and energy we could spend educating and mobilizing people for human rights. And I think part of the strategy of Israel lobby groups is simply to tie people up in these battles or lawsuits or whatever else they come up with and absorb our energy. But nonetheless, I think it is a reactionary strategy from them. They really can't sell Israel. They don't have a positive message to sell Israel as, you know, really a beacon of human rights or of, you know, whatever other positive associations they may have with it. So all they can do is try to shut down the discussion. And so we do see these anti-BDS laws and resolutions across the country. I think something like 25 U.S. states have passed various kinds of anti-BDS legislation. But here I think it's actually been a good news story from the perspective of the movement for Palestinian rights, because in every case, I think in all except one case I can think of, when these laws have been challenged in court, they have been overturned as unconstitutional. Yeah. And we've seen federal challenges to them in Kansas, in Arizona, in Texas, that have all been successful. And we saw another very worrying and damaging strategy used by the Israel lobby is going after universities to silence academics and students. And so the Trump administration actually appointed Kenneth Marcus as its chief enforcer of civil rights in the U.S. Department of Education when Trump came in. Who is Kenneth Marcus? He is actually a lifelong career Israel lobbyist who had pioneered the strategy of misusing the U.S. Civil Rights Act to try to go after universities by claiming that universities that don't crack down on Palestine solidarity activism are harming their Jewish students, are creating a hostile atmosphere for their Jewish students. And this strategy under Kenneth you know, he was at an outfit called the Brandeis Center, which has nothing to do with Brandeis University. It's just an Israel lobby group. And they had gone after a dozen universities around the country during the Obama administration, including several University of California campuses, Rutgers, Colombia, and others. And all of these cases were thrown out by the Department of, by the Office of Civil Rights at the Department of Education. They were all baseless. They were all thrown out. They were all politically motivated. They actually tried then to take some of these same cases to federal court. The one at UC Berkeley, for example, and that was thrown out of federal court. So then what happened after this total failure, the Trump administration appointed Kenneth Marcus, the guy who actually made these complaints or coordinated these complaints, they put him in charge of adjudicating them, if you can imagine that.
Yeah.
And so he spent the past two and a half years as the head of civil rights going, you know, trying to advance these complaints. Well, the good news is he just resigned under a cloud. It turns out that he had improperly used his, he'd basically abused power. I mean, there were hundreds of genuine civil rights complaints that were awaiting investigation and adjudication. He pushed all those aside in order to revive and give priority to the Rutgers complaint, which had already been thrown out and which he was allowing a pro-Israel group to refile just because he was there and perhaps he thought he could fix the result. So, you know, this is an example of where there are intense efforts at censorship and they take up a lot of time and effort for people to fight back against them. But the good news story is they're not succeeding. And when you do fight back, you win.
You know, those of us who know and respect Nora Arakat have been grieving with her and her family. It's around 40 days now since her nephew, Ahmed Arakat, was shot and killed by the Israeli military on his way to his sister's wedding. His body hasn't yet been released to the family. Do you have any updates or what can you tell us about the situation?
Well, that was just a horrific case. The killing of Ahmed Arakat is yet another example of a young Palestinian being basically extrajudicially executed by Israeli forces. And it was caught on video, like many of these horrific killings, but many more are not caught on video. So in this case, you could see that he presented absolutely no threat to the people who gunned him down. And sadly, there is no venue, let's say, or no mechanism for real justice because, you know, the Israelis are literally a judge, jury, and executioner. So there have been appeals by the family and by many Palestinian civil rights organizations for, you know, international pressure and investigations on Israel. But I wish I could say that the case of Ahmed Arakat was unique. It's far from unique. There have been literally dozens, hundreds of these extrajudicial killings, not to mention, of course, the more than 200 Palestinians gunned down by snipers, including many children, medics, journalists, elderly people, people using wheelchairs in the context of the Great March of Return protests in Gaza. So it just draws attention to the total impunity Israel enjoys because of the support from the United States and, of course, from the European Union and others. And that's why I think it's so important to challenge the complicity of these institutions and to challenge the complicity of corporations, of universities that treat Israel like a normal country, that reward Israel with, you know, very lucrative relationships, while Israel is committing these kinds of crimes with impunity. We should also mention, of course, the International Criminal Court, which is inching ever so slowly towards opening a formal investigation into Israel's war crimes. and it has yet to happen. We're still waiting for the judges there to decide on the extent of the court's jurisdiction. But it's been a years-long fight to get the ICC to actually start formally investigating these kinds of crimes. And one where I hope things have been moving very, very slowly, too slowly, in the right direction. But, I'll believe it when I see it. I'm not willing to say it's a done deal.
You know, we've been very concerned about the prison population, the Palestinian prison population within Israel and the military prisons, especially children and youth, and especially during this time of the pandemic when they're living, forced to live in these very, very close quarters where the disease or the virus can spread so easily. Catch us up with what's happening there.
Well, just in the last week or so, there was a decision from the Israeli Supreme Court in response to a challenge from human rights groups, a decision that Palestinian prisoners have no right to social distancing in Israeli detention. And this is sadly not surprising, but it's no less devastating because there are more than 4,700 Palestinian political prisoners in Israel's prisons. That includes more than 160 children at the present time, and about 1,000 prisoners who are considered very vulnerable, either due to chronic illness or old age. And there have been repeated calls by international bodies and by human rights groups, Palestinian, Israeli, and international, that Israel should release, at the very least, the children and the vulnerable prisoners. And yet it has not done so. And sadly, there have been documented cases of Palestinians who have been released from prison with and then tested positive for the coronavirus. There have been cases where Israeli prison guards have been known to be infected as well. So the prisons in Israel, where Palestinians are held, just like the prisons in the United States, are really ground zero for some of the worst outbreaks, unfortunately, because people in prison are so vulnerable and are so powerless and unable to do the kinds of things we're all asked to do to protect themselves. And there, the responsible parties are those who keep the prisons and keep people there. And so that's a crisis which is striking Palestinians as it is striking many incarcerated people in the United States.
I want to use that as a segue. We've interviewed here Reverend Liz Theo Harris from the Poor People's Campaign. She's the co-chair with Reverend William Barber of the Poor People's Campaign. And they talk about the pandemic here as having exposed the fissures already present in our country. And so I wanted to ask you to talk about some of these fissures that are present in our country and what the pandemic is teaching us about who we are as a people and as an American society.
Yeah, that's such a good way to put it, and it's a situation where we can be personally very, many of us, and as I said at the outset, I'm very thankful that I'm able to work at home, I'm able to remain relatively safe. Of course, the thing we all miss is the day-to-day contact with our friends, with our loved ones, with our colleagues. But at least for a certain amount of time, that's tolerable. What's not tolerable is the situation of people in prison. What's not tolerable is to see 50 million people made unemployed, to see a third of households unable to pay their rent or mortgages, to see a looming a catastrophe that is growing day by day, and to see the political system completely paralyzed and unable to meet the needs of the people in this country. People talk about the United States as a failed state. And sadly, I think that's true in many ways. We see Congress able to pass a massive military budget of $740 or $750 billion with barely a problem. And they're still arguing about whether people who are at risk of losing their homes should get a couple of hundred extra dollars a week just to hold on to the roof over their head. Yeah. And to see trillions of dollars doled out with barely any discussion to major corporations, many, you know, under the pretext that this is going to save jobs, and many of those same corporations then turning around and saying, oh, well, we're going to be laying off, you know, X many thousand people, as many of the airlines have done. So it's intolerable. But at the same time, you know, I think at the beginning of this, I don't know how many of us expected the huge upsurge or the resurgence in protest, the resurgence in resistance, the resurgence in radical demands for justice in this country, from defunding the police and prison abolition to pressing demands for a basic income, healthcare, really things that people in a country this rich should be able to take for granted. And, you know, maybe that's a sign of hope. I'm not trying to overestimate where we are. It's still a pretty dismal picture in so many ways. But people are alive. Communities are alive, and they're fighting and struggling to not just to survive, but to actually make a better world than the one that is behind us. And in Palestine, you know, we were all, many of us, aware of the fissures. But again, this pandemic has exposed so many of them, particularly in the way Israel has responded to the pandemic in terms of Palestinians. It has really done nothing to ameliorate the situation and much to make it worse, including refusing to loosen the siege of Gaza, including subjecting Palestinian laborers who have to go from the West Bank to Israel to earn money to feed their families. They have been exposed to the virus and then taken it back to their communities in the West Bank because they have no choice but to do that to survive. And so it has in so many ways exacerbated the already pre-existing injustices.
I have a question that's got two parts to it, Ali, so if you'll bear with me. You mentioned the protests and demonstrations that are going on in cities around the country. They've raised all kinds of issues, including systemic racism, the Black Lives Movement, police state violence, the Israelification of American domestic security. So I want you to say a word about that. But when we were interviewing our mutual friend, Max Blumenthal, he said that, and this is almost a quote, the Israel lobby sees the Black Lives Movement as a threat. So can you weave a response to those two parts of that question?
Yes, absolutely. I've written a couple of articles in the past few months precisely about how the Israel lobby views the Black Lives Matter movement as a threat. And this goes back a number of years, particularly it goes back to 2014 after the police killing of the teenager Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, and with the uprising that sparked, where we saw that, of course, happened during the same summer that Israel was bombing Gaza and killing on average 11 children a day in the summer of 2014. And so there was this reawakening of Black Palestinian solidarity between the United States and Palestine. And a new awareness. Of course, that solidarity goes back many years, many decades, to the 1960s, to the black radical movements that were internationalist, that saw Palestine as an anti-colonial struggle. But it reawakened in 2014. And what we saw after that was the Israeli government and Israel lobby groups really worried about the resurgence of black and Palestinian solidarity. Why? Because the Black Lives Matter movement has a great deal of legitimacy, particularly on the left, particularly among grassroots. And so they were just very worried about bringing the issue of Palestine into that fold. So, you know, you take Israel lobby groups, for example, the Anti-Defamation League, which is one I wrote about recently, which pose in the United States. They try to pose as very progressive, very much about interfaith and intercommunity and interracial relations and so on. But of course, they're supporters of Israeli apartheid, and they spend much of their effort trying to attack supporters of Palestinian human rights. So they actually had an internal memo that was leaked a few weeks ago to the publication Jewish Currents, laying out precisely this dilemma of how they can continue to appear to be progressive in the U.S. on issues like Black Lives Matter while maintaining their support for Israel. And it's a conundrum they can't solve, because what's also being exposed in all of this is the close ties between the American state apparatuses of repression at the federal, state, and local level and Israel. That's what you might call the Israelification, where many of these same Israel lobby groups have for decades been engaged in taking all the top police and law enforcement officials, and we're talking about FBI, Department of Homeland Security, state police, local police from the city of Chicago, from New York, from pretty much any sizable American city. I guarantee you, a top delegation of police officers has gone on one of these junkets to Israel, which are sponsored by AIPAC, the American Jewish Committee, the Anti-Defamation League, and others. But they're all involved in it. And the way they market it is, oh, Israel is so experienced in dealing with terrorism and security threats, and we're so smart at this. Come and see how we do it, so you can go back to the United States and apply the lessons you've learned. And that was a very good marketing strategy post 9/11. But in the era of Black Lives Matter, there's a backlash against it, because people are saying, why are our police driving down the streets in tanks? Why are our police in camouflage? Why are our police carrying assault rifles and wearing night goggles as if they're soldiers and we're their enemy? And I don't want to give the, you know, let's be very clear. We should not in any way take the idea that, you know, but for Israel, American police would be great and would not be racist. You know, sadly, U.S. police forces need lessons in racism from nobody. But what it is that Israel, in a way, provides an opportunity to launder this racism as, you know, sophisticated techniques and technology that are quote-unquote battle-tested and tested on the ground. What does that mean? That means tested on Palestinians under military occupation. It means tested on Palestinians in Gaza, caged in what is effectively a giant ghetto, and marketing that to American police departments. So this growing awareness, which comes through the black-led struggle of the Black Lives Matter movement, is another enormous challenge to the Israeli and Israel lobby narrative that they don't know how to deal with. But that, in a nutshell, is why they see why Israel and its lobby see Black Lives Matter as a growing threat.
That was Palestinian journalist Ali Abu Nima in conversation with Michael Spaff, director of the Indiana Center for Middle East Peace. Undeterred by COVID-19, Israel continues to brutalize West Bank residents. Israelis' ongoing weekly protests against Netanyahu's handling of the COVID-19 crisis ignore the brutal scene unfolding daily in the occupied West Bank. There have been at least 70 army raids over the past 2 weeks, including an August 27th attack on the Al-Fawar refugee camp, where a family was severely beaten and its money stolen. On September 6th, two brothers were critically injured in a Jenin refugee camp where soldiers blew up the door of their house. A sound bomb penetrated a Hebron hospital during an army raid on August 30th, forcing the evacuation of COVID-19 patients. Demonstrators against land expropriation have been subjected to live ammunition, tear gas, and sound bombs, and a picture taken of a September 1st protest in the village of Shufa near Tulkarem shows 65-year-old Kari Hanun pinned on the ground with a soldier's knee on his neck. And so life in Palestine continues under the rigors of military occupation and a growing viral pandemic. Even in Gaza, which is still under siege, where the virus is spreading, the rocket attacks from Israel continue unabated. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live every Thursday morning at kkrn.org at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, but at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, where it is broadcast out of Round Mountain, California. That's every Thursday morning. You can stream This Week in Palestine live at kkrn.org at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning. من مخيم